Our next guest is going to be talking about a special era of life that she calls the vintage years. It's from age 60 on. But as she arrived in the hallway today and we spoke about the fact that this is a very unusual day with a lot of news happening, she looked up and said, "I can relate. I was in New York for 9/11. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Francine Toder, a retired psychologist and professor emeritus from Sac State. Her new book, as I said, is The Vintage Years. She joins us in studio. Dr. Toder, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Beth. It's lovely to be here. And I understand the significance of the day and the need to possibly interfere with the broadcast. I do remember 9/11. It was a very chaotic time in New York City. But I'm glad to be here to be talking about my new book. It's actually titled The Vintage Years, Finding Your Inner Artist, Writer, Musician, Visual Artist After 60. It really focuses on the fine arts in this stage of life.
And you profile 20 people who are doing the most remarkable things with that stage of life. And there is a reason that you went down the pathway of this book. Just connect me to your own life at this point.
Yes. Well, at this point, I'm 2 years past my second retirement, first one from Sac State in 2000. My second one from private practice in Palo Alto as a clinical psychologist in about 2 years ago. And at that time, I began to think about, well, what do I want to do? And actually, I started thinking about that before retirement, as most people do. But what I'd like to do is read from the very beginning of the preface of the book, because it sort of explains what my mindset was at that time.
Absolutely. That would be great.
So I didn't set out to write a book that evolved into the vintage years. I began by pondering, as psychologists do, my current life stage at 60-plus chronological years, referred to variously as late adulthood, senior years, golden days, or less affectionately as old age or over the hill. Change is inevitable. Time passes swiftly. I look back at the circuitous path of more than 45 years as a psychologist, first on a college campus, later in private practice, and the many serendipitous twists that turns that took me to writing this book. Perhaps it was simply a matter of shifting priorities or interests, but as I approached age 70, I began to feel wanderlust for exploring what could be discovered in my own life. What's next? And if not now, when? Surfaced as nagging questions begging for answers. These could be the quintessential questions of what I call the vintage years, the first stage in life without a clearly laid out path and set of expectations. So that's exactly where I was at that time, and I began to search around for what interested me, and what I'd always wanted was to be a musician. And not to play just any instrument, but the cello.
Mm-hmm.
And the cello is a very complicated instrument. It has no frets. It's large. It's heavy to carry around. And everyone discouraged me in a nice way, patted me on the head, and said, "Why don't you try the recorder? You know, something simple."
Right.
But of course, the more they said that, the more determined I was. And then I was trying to find something that would do for my brain what I knew was possible at this point in life to keep the brain vital. I discovered through some of my research into neuroscience literature that there's a triad of qualities that are really necessary: novelty, complexity, and problem solving. And my theory at that time was that playing a musical instrument, or writing a memoir, or writing short stories, or doing fine arts like doing ceramics or doing watercolor painting does just that. They're complex processes.
And I love your phrase, by the way, wanderlust at 70. I want you to bottle that and make sure I have it at that stage of my life. But you're not alone in this, because the big population bubble we have, the baby boomers, are all passing through their 60s right now. And it's a large number.
Yes, that's right. I brought a couple of statistics I can quickly read. Every 7 seconds, someone turns 55.
Huh.
Every day for the next 18 years, 10,000 baby boomers will reach 65. Someone is already born, get this, who will likely to live to be 150.
Really? I didn't think our bodies had the capacity past 115 or 120.
I Well, again, someone who was born right now has a different trajectory than those of us who were born in the earlier part of 20th century. And this is the first time in history that most of us over 60 may still have a third of our life left to live.
Oh, what a thought that is.
So how we live life after 60 is really critical to our well-being.
We can't talk about the whole life, but let's talk about our brains, because that's where a lot of your work focuses, and that's also where this delight of the inner artist plays. So what's happening to our brains, the mature brain, you call it?
Right, the mature brain. Well, at midlife, certain things happen that actually facilitate taking up a fine art form. One of them is, well, neuroplasticity is something that has been discovered in the last 20 years, and this suggests that the brain really is plastic. It is capable of reshaping itself, and if any part of a normal brain isn't working as well as it should, and this sort of accounts for what happens in the right brain as we age, and we have what we call senior moments, where we can remember what happened 20 years ago, but not what we ate last night or where we put our keys. That neuroplasticity allows us to be drawing upon different parts of the brain that we didn't use previously for the same function. Then there's a shift called bilaterality, where the right side of the brain is, which is the part that doesn't do so well later in life, it's the part where short-term memory is difficult, is boosted by the work of the left brain. So now you've got two sides of the brain working together, and as the literature suggests, two sides are better than one.
Oh, that sounds good. But we also have lifestyle happening in there too, don't we, Francine?
Yes.
It's a different time of freedom and the ability, as you said, to just think, you know, regardless of what anybody else says, maybe I can pick up the cello now.
Well, that's right, because there are no consequences for failing, for example. There's no competition. There's no need to perform. Performance belongs to adulthood between the years of, you know, basically 30 and 60. We're less interested at this stage in life in what other people think. So it really is a very freeing thing. And because people generally have more time, even if they're still working, this is, by the way, retirement is not required to pursue the arts or to enjoy the vintage years. You can still do it because you're still going to have more time. If you've had children, they're generally out of the house or they may be coming back into the house, but you have less direct responsibility. And there are some hormonal shifts also in the body, so that there's actually a decrease in estrogen and testosterone. And so there's more focus on things like the fine arts, more attention span, just generally a more relaxing of the psyche and the body.
I'm speaking with Dr. Francine Toder. Her book is The Vintage Years, and I promised you that I would bring you any updates at the moment in the news from Boston. So I do want to let you know I'm being handed this at the moment to tell you that local, state, and federal law enforcement officers, including the Secret Service, are now undertaking a door-to-door search of the area in Watertown. If you have family or friends there, you might be in contact with them and know that there is a stay-inside order. So authorities are moving house to house. This includes canine teams, explosives experts, and SWAT officers that are involved. And this is according to state police spokesman David Precipio. And the search at this point is about 60% complete. We continue to monitor NPR News, and we'll bring you the latest update. Meanwhile, it's kind of a delicate balance of walking forward with our Insight program today. But again, Dr. Toder understands, and just to reflect, when you were in New York in 9/11, you were with Red Cross volunteers. Were you a volunteer at that point?
Yeah, I actually went there. I was the, the County Psychological Association. I was the person in charge of disaster mental health, and I was one of the first to volunteer to go to Ground Zero. And when I got there, I was assigned to what they call an IRV, which is a Red Cross vehicle that went to Ground Zero, to the very spot where the hole was in the ground, to a makeshift building that was being staffed by firefighters and police at that time. And my job was to go there and just check on people and in an informal way while delivering coffee, also check to see how they were doing and to see if any people in the neighborhood needed psychological support.
Well, I know you could speak to the fact that while we might have thought that the people most impacted, and of course they were those at the explosion, the impact of what has happened since last night with this manhunt and
right.
the additional casualties and now this door-to-door search will be a challenge for people, for families, for the community.
This is true, except one of the things that I found having been there, and actually I was there for the crash at Rockaway 3 weeks later, and I was the first psychologist on the scene after that airplane crash, which everyone thought was a terrorist attack, and it actually wasn't. But people are traumatized, but as a culture, you know, and New Yorkers are pretty resilient, and so people do snap back. And there was just a tremendous sharing and community spirit that helped people get back to the state that they were in before it all happened. But it is very upsetting for most people. And yet we're resilient.
We have celebrated the kindness, the volunteer spirit, the goodness in people of all ages. Your book deals with those vintage years from 60 on. And you talk about feeding your brain, which we were mentioning a moment ago, a certain diet.
Yeah.
And you said they're really those aspects of complexity, newness, and problem solving.
Right.
So share with me some of the things that you do in your daily life that you see other people doing in their daily lives that's feeding the brain that way?
Well, again, my choice was to continue writing. And this is my third book that I've written. And that's something that both gives me comfort and keeps my brain sharp. I play the cello every day for 40 minutes. And by the way, I've been playing for 3 years now, even though I was, you know, discouraged from doing so. And my teacher thinks that in another couple of years, I might be good enough to actually play with a small chamber group.
Oh, how exciting.
I mean, of volunteers, you know, not performing professionally for anyone. But that's fine, because that isn't my goal. My goal isn't to climb any kind of a ladder in terms of performance, but to have pleasure, to have meaningfulness, and to really be inspired and interested in my own life.
So those 40 minutes a day are a time period you really look forward to.
I do, and it's a wonderful distraction. The other thing I noticed when I interviewed a large number of people, of whom 20 finally appear in the book, that people use their art form for all kinds of things. They fill their time with it. They re-engage and meet new people, expand their community. But they also deal with pain that way. Mm-hmm. Because there are many of the people I interviewed. And by the way, when any of us turn, by the time we turn 60, we've had crises and we've had trying kind of events in our lives. And one woman went to an art class after she fell on her knee and didn't realize till 4 hours later that her knee was as big as a watermelon and she couldn't walk. Being immersed in her art form actually allowed her to be anesthetized.
Ah, when you lose yourself in
yes.
what you're doing.
Right.
Just with the mention of those 20 people, I was reading this interesting detail in the book that you traveled to meet everybody
uh-huh.
in wherever their workspace was, wherever their life
right.
was.
Right.
And I don't know if you meant it seriously or jokingly, but you said, if there's any pattern to the lifestyles of the artists I've interviewed, it's the remoteness of their homes and the difficulties posed to me in
yeah.
finding them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a special
yeah.
way of enjoying life that doesn't have to be yeah. smack in the middle of a busy neighborhood.
That's right. And it really depends on people's personalities as to where they place themselves, both in terms of physically living as well as how they deal with their art form. Some people take classes, some people just start writing, and the writers are probably the most introverted of the groups. I sort of meant it sort of half as a joke and half seriously, but it's true. But finding people where they lived was a challenge.
I'm looking for this one. He was a wood carver. Is he in his 90s?
Right,
he fascinated me.
Yes.
And he had his calendar and he was punctual and alert.
And I actually want to talk about Henry. Henry is just turned 97. I interviewed him in New Jersey when he was 96. But when I talked to Henry, who is a wood sculptor, his early life was really unremarkable. It had nothing to do with the arts. He wasn't raised to do any arts, but he made his own toys. And he described making little cars and trucks out of wood with a penknife. He never put it together that his early years making toys would somehow lead to his later years, starting at 68 when he became a wood sculptor after he retired and tried to figure out what else to do. But in his middle years, his profession actually related to all of it, and that is he was a butcher. And what does a butcher do? A butcher cuts meat.
Carves.
He carves. But then he told me this incredible story that gave me goosebumps, and that was in the course of meeting with him, he said, "You know, I remember sculpting something else." He said, "I had a cake of ivory soap, and I sculpted it with my penknife. I made it into a little car." And he said, "You know what? I still have it." Mm. I said, "Oh, my God." You know, it was like, it was 90 years old. Mm. And he said, "I can find it." And he pulled it out, and there it was, little brown cake of ivory soap. And for people who aren't old enough to remember a cake of ivory soap, it's just that, a little white cake of soap. And here it was, a little brown car.
And it floats. I remember that part.
Yeah.
Well, this is a fun little reunion for us. Your second book was Your Kids Are Grown, Moving On With and Without Them. But your first book came out in 1986, and it was When Your Child Is Gone, Learning to Live Again. I interviewed you when I was co-anchoring the noon news at KCRA with Mike Boyd.
That's right.
And it was so many years ago. I couldn't have even envisioned that stage of my life. And here I am sitting across from you dealing with exactly that.
That's right.
And I think you're more vibrant than ever.
Oh, thank you. Well, see, that's one of the advantages of the vintage years, because you have wisdom. You have the benefit of a lifetime of learning and experiences. But thank you.
So I don't know if this is a plus or minus. I know it's at least funny, but you did bring along a picture from that day long ago on the Channel 3 news set. So I'll take a picture and tweet it out. And it's nice to remember Mike Boyd, who we lost a few years ago.
Oh,
but
I'm sorry.
Good to have a reunion with you.
Yes.
Congratulations on this very interesting book that appeals to me now differently than it would have back then.
Thank you. Yes, to me as well. This is why I wrote it now and
All
not
right.
then.
I do want to let folks know you're here for the weekend, too, because you'll be at the Arden Dimmick Library tomorrow at 2 and then at the Avid Reader on Sunday at 2.
Yes, the Avid Reader in Sacramento.
In Sacramento. And you have other talks that are happening, so we'll link the information to our website.
Great.
Dr. Francine Toder, thanks again.
Thank you, Beth. This was a wonderful day.
Happy reunion.
Yes.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio.
Call 1-800-800-5867 and support Insight here at Northern California and Western Nevada. 1-800-800-5867 for all the different topics, all the different voices that you hear on a weekly basis. Consider $25 a month on our Evergreen program when you call 800-800-5867.
At Capital Public Radio, our focus is always to serve you in the best ways possible. One example is a change that we've recently made at our webpage, capradio.org. We've always offered the podcast of Insight as an hour-long program, but now, in addition to that hour-long podcast, we also break out each segment of the show so you can just pick and choose what you want to hear when you go to capradio.org/insight. It's one of the things you've asked us for many years, and we are delivering it. And it's all because of you and your generous support. Call now, 1-800-800-5867, or go online, capradio.org.
Additionally, we get support from European Sleep Design, celebrating their 10th anniversary. They feature adjustable beds with ergonomic properties for optimal body alignment and adjustable comfort. European Sleep Design in Folsom and at sleepdesign.com. And support comes from the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.com. capitalpublicradio.org. Think about how often you listen to Capital Public Radio and all of the news that you've gotten in the last year. If it's time for you to renew, now's the time to do it. 1-800-800-5867. Give us a call, make a contribution in any amount, and help support Insights on Capital Public Radio. It's 1-800-800-5867, or check out the different ways we're saying thanks at our website. That's capradio.org. You support these programs on public radio. It's listener-powered radio. Make that contribution today. 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org.